Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, coming from some of the most interesting people in the professional snow and ice management industry. To learn about their successes, to hear about the challenges they've faced along the way, and to have their perspective on critical issues facing our industry today. Before we get started, I'd like to invite you to follow our social media feeds and to check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com. Please welcome your host, Phil Harwood.
All right, welcome back, Snowfighters. I am so excited today to have as our special guest, Natalie Mualim. She is an attorney specializing in employment immigration. She works with business owners and throughout the U.S. Yes, Natalie?
Yes.
We're excited to hear about you and what you do for a living and how you can help us because, you know, more and more, you know, I think we're just all looking for a good solution when it comes to labor. And it's been such a issue for many, many years, decades, in fact. I remember, you know, going way back in my career, you know, not at the beginning of my career, but certainly for the past 15, 20 years, we've been talking about labor issues for a long time. So this is really nothing new, but it seems to be getting even more acute. So I think this is really timely for us to be having this conversation, just hearing about some really good options that maybe we hear about and we think, well, it's really not for me, but maybe it is. So we're going to jump into this. So, all right. So Natalie, tell us about yourself.
Sure. So as you said, my name is Natalie Mualim. I'm based in Cleveland, but I have clients all over the United States. My firm focuses primarily on employment-based immigration with a very heavy emphasis on the H-2B visa program. So what I do is I help companies that have a seasonal or temporary need fill that gap with foreign labor, and we try to ensure compliance throughout the process, as well as obviously there's a lottery that's attached to the H-2B program that makes it very competitive. So we try to help our clients by creating strategies to really maximize what they can get out of the program and increase their odds of actually having workers on the ground once they apply.
Great. So I definitely want to talk about H-2B because, you know, there are certainly people listening to this who have some experience, but there are a lot of other people who don't. And so I'd really like to understand more fully what that is and how that works and what the deadlines are and just, you know, some of the things that I hear on the street. So I'll pepper you with some of those things that you've heard about, you know, H-2B. But I also, you know, want to explore, you know, some of the other things that you might be able to help as well with, aside from H-2B. So what are some of the other things that you get involved in that maybe we want to spend a few minutes talking about?
Sure. So I think the one of the most common things is I help investors. So there's a program called the E2 program, and it's for individuals from certain countries. And the list is pretty long. But as long as that individual is from one of those treaty countries, they can come and invest in the United States. And the investment account amounts are a lot lower than you would think. Like it could be as low as $60,000, $70,000 to invest in a business. So I help entrepreneurs with that. I also help people with extraordinary abilities come to the United States where they self-sponsor. So basically, if you're the best of the best at what you do, and that could be in any field, you don't really need somebody to sponsor you. You can self-sponsor in the United States. And then I also help companies that that maybe have a workforce that's foreign, either get them H-1B visas, which is for professionals. So let's say there's a landscaping company that needs an accountant, or I'm doing one right now for a construction company that needs a project manager. So more specialized work, or even get their workforce green card. So, you know, we have people that maybe have used H-2B or used other programs, or just recently met somebody that they think is a good candidate. So we can help them throughout the process of obtaining a green card as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely want to spend a few minutes there because, you know, that's one of the things that I hear about H-2B is people think, well, if I bring someone over, you know, and I get involved in H-2B, then there's really no other options for those folks. And we're really confined. So I'd love to hear about maybe some other ways, you know, And I know things are probably changing with the new administration, but we'll talk about the way things have been.
Sure.
So we'll speculate. Yeah, go ahead.
So with H-2B, the idea of it is it's a temporary job. So that's what makes it unique and that's what makes it different. So we have to prove to the government that this job is not ongoing throughout the year. There's a special type of H-2B called a one-time occurrence where it could be a maximum of 3 years, but that's really defined to very, very specific circumstances. Usually what we have to say is either the work is seasonal, meaning that for certain months of the year, this occupation doesn't exist. So, for a lot of your snow cleaners, that would apply. Nobody's probably cleaning snow in July in the United States. Or it could be peak load, where, like, let's say somebody has construction work and they do construction year round, but there's certain months where that really slows down. So the idea for H-2B is because it's seasonal and because it's temporary, we have a special visa program for that. But let's say you bring somebody over and you really like them and you think that they would be a great addition to your team. We can definitely sponsor them for the green card. The issue with that is it does take several years to get the green card. So the way that it typically happens is you bring somebody on an H-2B, you try them out, you make sure that you like them. And then if you do and you think they're a good addition to your team, we apply for the green card in the background. So the green card process starts, but you still use the H-2B program to fill that gap until they actually get a green card. So it's not usually one or the other, especially for unskilled labor or mild, basically we call it unskilled, but it's anything that requires less than 2 years of experience. But let's say you're petitioning for somebody that's like a director of marketing at a large company, they could probably, forgo the H-2B process and come straight to the marketing director role because the green card process is a lot shorter. But for people that are that don't have a bachelor's degree or that are unskilled, quote unquote, they obviously, use that terminology, then you do need probably the H-2B to get the process rolling and then you can turn it into a green card.
Got it. Okay. I'd like to stay on the green card for a little bit more, and then I want to go back to then really get into the H-2B. So if someone, let's say someone is here on an H-2B visa or has been for, maybe several years, and you're like, oh, this person's really solid and they want to stay here and could really use them year round and everything else, or maybe they're already here, for other reasons. But what does that look like to get a green card? Are there limitations? Is it just a matter of, you just have to wait? Is it a timing thing? Is it a money thing? Like what's involved?
All of the above. So there's three parts to the green card.
But there's no lottery, right? It's not a lottery. No. Is it kind of guaranteed as long as you jump through the hoops?
So it's hard to say anything is guaranteed with immigration. There's no lottery, but there's a cap on the number of visas.
Got
but it's
it.
Not
okay.
Like the H-2Bs where like there's a lottery and then if you don't make it, you don't make it for that year. It's just think of it as a queue. So you're in a line and then each year they take a certain number and it might take 2-3 years for them to get to.
Okay.
But it's not quite a lottery.
I see.
The process itself is pretty predictable if you are working with counsel that is experienced in it. We typically try to divide it into three categories. There's the Department of Labor, there's the USCIS or the Department of Homeland Security, and then there's the Department of State. So how it works is, first of all, we have to show that we're paying the accurate wage. And we have to show that we've advertised for the job and there's no U.S. takers. And that's where a lot of people probably have heard of the two Sunday ads. And then we have to show that the person actually qualifies for what we're asking for. So if you're saying that your job requires, 5 months of experience using a software program and then, 2 months on, maybe a 2 month training certificate or something like that, but your candidate doesn't have that, then they don't obviously qualify. So we do that through the Department of Labor, and there's usually a year to year and a half wait with the Department of Labor before you actually get the position certified. Once it's certified, then you move on to the I-140 stage, which is with the Department of Homeland Security. And they will make sure that the employer has the ability to pay the wages, as well as make sure that the candidate, again, qualifies and that you've gone through all the steps. Sometimes there's audits, which make the process go slower. But if there's no audits, the I-140 can be as quick as 15 days if you pay premium processing, and it can be as long as almost a year if you don't. And then after that part, then we either, if the person is in the United States, we do what's called an adjustment of status, or if they're out of the United States at the time, we do consular processing with the Department of State. So overall, the process again is pretty predictable. We know what's going to happen. It's just making sure that the person has the criteria and that when you're testing the market, you're doing it in a way that makes sense for the position. So like, again, we have to show that no U.S. candidates are available. So that's why it becomes super important where our standards are. And we can't, you know, set the standard very low because then everybody qualifies, and we can't set the standard really high because then your wage is probably not fair market value. So for what you need. So it's really a balancing act between those two things. And then there's a little criteria that sometimes becomes a bump in the road for companies that need workers without very high skills. It's that you can't have all the worker skills come from your company. So let's say you brought somebody in and they had absolutely no knowledge about what you do. You train them up to a really, you know, professional point. We can't require that knowledge to be part of the application if it all came from you. So if that's the case, we have to make the new job 50% different, or we have to use their experience from other places to supplement that visa as well.
Okay. All right. No, that was really helpful. So what would, you know, if someone was going to go down this road of getting someone a green card, what roughly should they be thinking in terms of investment? If the company was going to pay for it, what would kind of a normal range be?
Sure. So the company does have to pay for the first part. The Department of Labor itself actually does not have fees attached to it. So that's, you know, helpful. But you do have to pay for the two Sunday ads. That cost varies. And as well as the other recruitment, it varies mm-hmm. dramatically based on where you're located. So like I have done some in Cleveland where the cost of the two Sunday ads was like $300-$400. And then we've done some in Miami where it's several thousands of dollars per ad. So it really just depends on that. And then the USCIS, if you don't do premium processing, it's about $700. If you do, you're adding an additional $2,800. And then the last part of the process, which is the adjustment of status, varies depending on whether it's adjustment of status or whether you're doing it out of the country. But that part, you can actually require the worker to pay for if you'd like. But usually that's about $1,000 as well. And then on top of that, okay. of course, you have attorney's fees, which mm-hmm. differ from office to office. What most of my companies do to make it more affordable is we do these in batches. So if you have five or six landscapers or construction laborers together, mm-hmm. we bundle that package together. So because because it's really the same process, you pay just a little additional premium per person, but your base rate stays the same. So mm-hmm. whatever the cost is, you know, the Sunday ads and the attorney's fees and all of that, it's getting divided mm-hmm. amongst your five or six candidates versus
doing it. Really smart. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's fantastic. I honestly just don't hear too many people even talking about that option. But to me, that sounds like a really smart way to go, especially if you have some really good people and you're like, you know, because that's one of the things let's move toward the H2B conversation. You know, it's one of the things I keep hearing about H2B is, you know, people say, oh, it's a drug, you know, and once you get hooked on it, you know, you, all of a sudden, you know, you don't win the lottery and you're in, you know, you're in trouble, you know, you're fighting for your life. So, and I guess that's kind of true, right? I mean, if you have a bunch of folks you're trying to get through HCB and you miss your deadlines or you don't win the lottery, I guess. But so talk me through this. How do you work when companies have those fears? I mean, what do you do to try to help them, you know, win at this game?
Sure. So there's a lot of strategies that I think are underutilized for H2B. And I've gained a lot of clients throughout the years because those strategies are underutilized. And, you know, they apply for H2B for the first time. Nobody tells them about the risks and then they don't, you know, get good results and they're completely flustered. And then they hear, you know, there's options and things that you can do to make it better. And, you know, it gains their attention again and we're able to work together. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take like just a minute to explain the lottery process and the.
No, please do. This is very important because some people don't know any about this, anything, or maybe it's changed since they last looked into it. So please do.
So the with the H-2B lottery process or the visa process, there are 66,000 visas that are allocated by Congress. So those are basically like set in stone. There used to be a list of countries that are eligible, but recently any country technically is eligible for H-2Bs. Those 66,000 visas, though, they're not released all together. And I think that's what causes some confusion. There's actually two batches. The first one begins in October because that's considered the beginning of the fiscal year for the federal government. So the new year, when we talk about a new fiscal year for H-2B, we're talking about October 1. And then the second group of visas is issued April 1. And what typically happens is because of the industries that use H-2B, they're usually hospitality, landscaping, construction. Everybody is fighting for those April 1 slots, and that's the second part of the year. But the October visas are a lot more underutilized. So there's been a lottery recently for them, but it's not a, you know, 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 chance like the April one. It's about a 95% chance of making it into the lottery. So it's much, much higher. The nice thing about it is that whoever enters through the first fiscal half of the year is actually exempt for the second half. So let's say you have somebody that came in October and they stayed for, you know, 1, 2, 3 months, and then they went back home. Next April, while everybody is, you know, fighting for those visas in April, your workers are already exempt. So that becomes a really, really helpful tool. And the nice thing about it too, is it's not only your workers, it's any worker that entered in October, because it latches onto the visa itself and not to the company. So you could potentially work with other companies that have cap exempt workers and gain that exemption through them. And the other thing that's recently been happening, and I would say, you know, really across both administrations, but in different ways, is there's been a supplemental cap. We don't know if it's happening this year or not, obviously, but the supplemental cap is a bonus round of visas. So the government has realized that the 66,000 visas is not enough and basically has doubled that number every year for the past several years. So not only do you have the 66,000, you are also able to keep applying. And usually the lottery, the April one especially, it goes in alphabetical order. So everybody gets put into the computer system and each petition gets placed in group A through usually like G or F, depending on how many applications they've received. And then they start processing it in that order. So group A makes the cap, group B about 40% make the cap, and then everybody else is capped out. But then, you know, now with the supplemental visas, group really all the way through E usually makes some sort of cap. And whether that's the normal supplemental or there's an allotment of 20,000 visas just for people from the Northern Triangle countries, which is like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica, and Ecuador. And then they just added Colombia as well this year. So for those countries, there's 20,000 visas. Plus you have any worker who's been returning within the last 3 years is eligible for supplemental cap. So the numbers look daunting at first, but if you really look at it and you're able to utilize other avenues, you know, I would say at least 80% of companies are getting what they need. And then for companies that use October as well as April, that number shoots up to like 97, 98%. And then there's also with the lottery, it's really like you have to think of it as each petition is like buying a ticket to the lottery. So for companies that have multiple locations or maybe multiple positions, we're able to file more than one petition. And then, you know, you have your chances multiply every time you apply for positions as well. So what my team does is we look at every application individually and see how we can maximize those chances. And we've had really, really good success rates so far with almost every company getting their workers if they're open to different options, of course. And what happens is, you know, you have not only will you get your workers, but it builds almost like a cycle so that your workers return every single year without having to be at the mercy of the lottery again. And then obviously, you know, with your audience being snow cleaners, most of them would fall under that October cap where it's very much less competitive. And then they can use that as an advantage in the future, whether they have spring work or whether they want to work with a company that has spring work. You can get some of your costs covered by the other company because they're gaining the exemption that you have. So there's a lot of strategic things that can be done, especially for companies that have a need in the winter or in the early fall.
Mm-hmm. For someone who is unfamiliar with how this whole process works, How would you, how, you know, a basic question I'm thinking about that someone might be asking is, how do you find people? You know, where do these people come from? How do you vet them?
Sure. So there's a lot of companies will have somebody in the United States that they trust and happens to be a foreign national, and they'll use that. They'll, you know, basically have people saying, you know, I have one guy, but he has cousins and uncles and, you know, and aunts and, you know, brothers. And that's how they, you know, start with the process. And then people will refer you to other people. So that's really a really good way to get started if you have that option, because people will then be loyal to their family and want to do a good job. And, you know, I vouched for you, so don't embarrass me, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't happen, well, our firms usually work with different recruiters overseas. So my firm, for example, has a recruiter in Mexico, and then I have a recruiter in the Northern Triangle countries. Mm-hmm. And then for my farming clients, I have a recruiter in Ukraine. But we do also Jamaica. We do, you know, really all parts of the world that are eligible. I have people in Philippines as well. So we work with reputable recruiting companies and help you basically identify the workers that way. You give us your criteria, you give us what you really need. And then if you want the opportunity to interview people, we can arrange for that. Like, we have some companies that actually will fly out to Mexico and interview mm-hmm. people that we've identified, others that just do it virtually. I have somebody this week that's doing their interviews fully virtually on, you know, a computer screen. And then people are coming into the office in Mexico, sitting down, getting interviewed. And you know, he gets to have an impression of the people that he's going to be working with. But really, there's a lot of reputable sources for labor overseas. And we always look at things like, has this person been on an H-2B before? Do they have good references? Are we able to verify their employment overseas? So that's never really been a huge problem of just finding people overseas. Thankfully, we've never had that issue. And there's a very low turnover rate. So I would say out of, you know, every 1,000 workers, the turnover rate's probably, you know, 50 or so. So it's relatively low. And sometimes we can identify very clearly what the reasons are. Other times it's, you know, just, you know, people have things that happen in their life that they mm-hmm. you know, expect.
Yeah. Just kind of high level, what would you say are maybe the top couple pros of H-2B, and what are the big cons, or, you know, pros and cons?
Sure. So I think for pros, it's a good, reliable source of labor. And I think that the people that come here on H-2Bs really want to work hard. They are always asking for more hours. There's not that whole struggle of, you know, I have an employee, they're just not motivated to work. They're here to work. That's the only reason they're here, is they want to work, they want to make money, they want to go back home at the end of the contract. The other big pro of it, I think, is you get to basically a lot of companies are just fishing in a very small pool, right? Like, your local area defines your business, and you're not able to expand beyond that because you're limited with what you have. And, you know, sometimes it's as simple as a factory opening up in your town, and then all of a sudden you lose all the eligible people that are available to you. And usually people within the United States aren't moving as much for these jobs. So you have really an unlimited potential for getting the type of employee that you really want. I think the cons are for companies that maybe don't know how to navigate the H-2B process. They are left at that, you know, like you said, the mercy of the lottery each year, which is something that we never want happening. And then the other negative, I think, is because, you know, first of all, you have the lottery and all of that, and the different policy changes that happen. But I think the other negative is sometimes it's a different culture, right? So you need to maybe make some adjustments to your team, or make some adjustments to the way that you operate to accommodate, whether it's a language barrier or just a culture difference or whatever it is. But I think, you know, depending on the company, that could be a major change, or sometimes it's just like a minor tweak here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the one thing I have heard across the board, and I saw this in my own company, is the workers from out of the country who are here to work like to work.
Yes.
They want as many hours as they can get, and they will work, and they'll work all day long. They're not going to be watching the clock, trying to get home at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. They're here to work. And it's amazing the sacrifices that they endure being here. We had, in my experience, you know, we did in my company before I started consulting, we didn't do any H2B work, but I knew a lot of companies that did. But we had a lot of folks from Mexico and from Guatemala and different countries, and they were our best workers by far.
And they don't have their families here as well. So, you know, a lot of times I don't think what I think doesn't like come across is, you know, if you don't have somebody to go back home to at the end of the day, you're motivated by like, I want to finish, I want to do the best job, I want to make the most money, so when I go home, I can actually enjoy the time with my family. And that's what I hear from a lot of workers and a lot of people that are here on H2B of, you know, I'm here to really put my head down, make the most out of this opportunity. And they really do view it as an opportunity and as a blessing. Like the mm-hmm. messages that we get after the H2B contracts are over of people thanking us for just the opportunity that we match them up with the company. I mean, it's really amazing to see that different point of view. And like I said, they don't have their families here typically. So the only thing left to do is work and mm-hmm. to do a good job at it and impress people, because you know that next year, if you don't do a good job, you're not coming back. So it's a lot of, I think that's really like, I've had multiple companies tell me that it's transformed their business because mm-hmm. of that mentality. And then it motivates your US staff too, because they see what can be done and what's possible and really like what, you know, what the work ethics look like, and they'll copy and follow suit as well.
Well, that's exactly right. Because we, you know, let's be honest, you know, the typical American, you know, 20-year-old doesn't have the greatest work ethic today, especially in a, you know, field service environment. And so to have that work ethic culturally in your organization is so important, so huge. And that culture, that cultural shift of taking your work seriously but with a smile, you know, and just enjoying working but being a family, like there's such a family orientation. I just think it's fantastic. I would just, if anyone's thinking, oh, I just don't know how that would look to have, you know, part of my workforce from out of the country, and maybe I can't speak Spanish or whatever language you're dealing. Hopefully not, we don't have to learn Ukraine, you know, but you know, there's just so many benefits. Anyway, I want to shift gears a little bit, because I'm really intrigued by, you know, anyone who gets into this line of work as a profession. So I'd love to hear about, you know, what inspired you to be an attorney and then to really, you know, be involved in this area of law specifically. Which one came first? Did you want to be an attorney ever since you were a little girl, or did you want to be involved in this and then the only pathway was to be an attorney, or how did that work?
So I have a journal that I recently posted on my LinkedIn and Facebook from when I was in third grade, talking about how I wanted to be an attorney. At the time, it was really funny. I was like, I argue with my sister very well, and I think I'm going to make it and go to Harvard, but maybe if not, I'll go to Yale, and, you know, just
really wow. Like that's impressive.
Right. But I really, you know, ever since I was little, I was intrigued by law and by this idea of, you know, justice and how we could have people advocate for others where, you know, they're basically, you know, convincing somebody of what's the right thing to do. And like this, you know, notion of being a lawyer. So when I graduated high school, I thought I was, you know, not going to be a lawyer anymore. I had kind of given up on that dream a little bit, because it was right around the like law school bubble, and a lot of lawyers that I knew and my parents knew were saying it's no longer like a lucrative career, and maybe consider something else and do something safe. So I actually have a degree in chemistry and then a master's degree in molecular genetics.
What?
Very different from what I do.
That's
now.
Way too much education.
I'm like, I don't even know how I did it. Like looking back, I'm like, I don't even know what I'm going to do with all this, you know, chemistry information, besides like now I read a lot of food labels all the time. And I'm like, I know what that is. But basically I thought I was going to go and do something in the science or medical field, and, you know, was took the DAT. I was admitted into dental school. And then I had that like summer before where you can basically intern or do something so that you're learning a little bit more. And that's exactly what I did. And I absolutely hated it day one. And I was like trying to convince myself like, no, this is something, this is great. You should do this. And really by the end of the summer, it was like midway through the summer, I was like, I don't think I can do this. So I went and I sat for the bar, for the LSAT. And it was a rush decision. And I applied for law school. It was 3 days before the term had started. So my first, yes, it was like, I knew I wanted to do it. And I thought, okay, I'll be a patent attorney because I have the science experience and everything like that. So I knew I wanted to, you know, change something. And I applied 3 days before the semester started. And I actually began that day. I didn't have a place to stay. I didn't have a car at the time. I didn't have a house. I was staying at the hotel in this campus because that was like my, you know, it was either that or I'd have to wait another year. And I was like, I'm just going to do this. And then I'll figure it out. And I ended up loving this, the law school I went to, and I ended up staying, and it was amazing. But it was really like, when I say last minute, it was really last minute, but just something I feel like in the like back of my mind, and, you know, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, that like, what if it would have stayed there if I didn't do it. So I graduated law school and I thought I was going to do something patent related. And at the time that I was in law school, a lot of changes had happened to patent law, especially when it came to genetic patents. And that's what I knew. Like I knew how to do those and I had worked with those, but there was a lot of case law changes when it was particularly like the breast cancer detection test. Mm. So they basically had changed a lot of the law, and the like my specialty was no longer pertinent. But because I'm an immigrant myself and my family came here as immigrants and they had a really long path towards immigration here in the United States, I had like learned along, you know, the process along with them. And I worked at a nonprofit during law school and a little bit after law school where I was like volunteering to help people that, you know, maybe needed help with their naturalization papers or, you know, family petitions. And it really introduced me to the field. And once I graduated and actually started working, I was hired to do corporate law. And it kind of, I saw the marriage between like corporate law and immigration, and I absolutely mm-hmm. loved it. I felt like I was helping companies. I was also, you know, helping immigrants in an indirect way by providing them with these opportunities. And I felt like it was a really good spot where it's like a win-win situation. And I got to use both sets of like law that I had learned. So both the corporate. So now I'm like, I feel like with H2B, a lot of it's reading payroll and corporate documents and all of that. And I feel like I do it well because I have that background mm-hmm. as well as obviously understanding the immigration system.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Well, let's talk a little bit. We have a few more minutes here. I'm interested in how, or what solutions you can bring to the table for someone who's involved in snow removal, because, you know, the snow and ice industry, you know, it's not only seasonal, it's extremely up and down. Right. So, you know, this and people say, oh, it could be, you know, it's not snowing at my house, but a mile down the road, it's snowing like crazy. And like, everyone says that like, no, sure. That's just weather. That's not Cleveland. That's just Cleveland has its own nuances. But, you know, a city could have, you know, 3 inches of snow 1 year and the next year they could have 100 inches. So what do you do when you're providing labor, especially when you have this, you know, contract labor scenario and when you have those huge variations? How does this work?
Sure. So what we typically do is we build a job description to be a little bit more broad than snow removal. So I typically have the job categorized as janitorial, which includes snow removal, but it includes a lot of other things as well. It includes like minor maintenance to equipment. It includes, you know, removing debris off construction sites. It includes leaf pickup. It includes a lot more than just a typical snow cleaning job. And when we do that, it gives us flexibility to either use the laborers for different tasks or even to subcontract out to different companies. So a lot of my snow cleaners will have running contracts with construction sites, and they basically will do removal of you know, debris off construction sites when it's not snowing. And then when it's snowing, you have an available crew that's ready to go. And then a lot of times we have companies that are either, you know, that's usually one of the two. They're either snow cleaning construction or they're snow cleaning landscaping. So then when the snow cleaning is not, you know, up to the standard where you need all the workers, then we have them work on different landscaping projects, whether that's, putting down mulch or maybe removing tree debris after storms or doing what have you that fits that job description. But by building it to be a little bit more broad, it gives the companies a lot more flexibility.
Did I hear you say you could subcontract an H2B person?
Yes, you can.
Okay. And that's legal?
Yes. So you basically, I mean, as long as you're controlling their labor, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Then yes, you can definitely be a subcontractor with H2B mm-hmm. labor. What you can't do is you can't basically have just the laborer go away without
you
being.
Okay. Got it. But they could be part of a subcontract arrangement where the company is the subcontractor.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Fantastic. That's good to know.
You can do it the other way, but you'd have to list that other company and you'd have to basically co-sponsor the worker. But most of my companies don't do that. They are, like you said, the whole company is subcontracting and that the labor falls under their jurisdiction.
What are some of the kind of best practices or tips that you've seen for companies who are using H2B that to help them be more successful with this program?
Sure. So I think you have to do a little bit of a mindset change. You know, having H2Bs doesn't fix your culture right away, right? Like it's if you have certain things that are happening that's causing your US workers to go away, you have to fix those before you introduce new people into the mix. But if for companies with good culture, but just, you know, limited resources when it comes to labor in terms of, you know, who's available, I think H2B is great. And what we typically advise our clients is try to use H2Bs as a way to expand your business. So, you know, there's obviously the limitation of labor that may be precluding you from signing on more contracts, but also there's some times where you could use H2B workers as a means to like fill that bottom layer, and then you can elevate people that are already there doing that, you know, doing that by giving them more tasks or more responsibilities. And then that way you're basically creating a continuum of skills. Mm-hmm. So not everybody is the same level. It helps companies scale a lot if they're interested in that. And then also what we, I always say is like, H2B helps you not have to subcontract so much of your work out too. So you can expand either vertically or horizontally in terms of having H2Bs. For best practices, really, it's make sure your files are in order, make sure you document things properly, make sure that you are, timely with payroll. That obviously goes for everybody, but, you know, especially with H2B, because you have a risk of being audited. So make sure you're timely with your payroll and with your documentation, and then be responsive to your attorney when they're, you know, going through the process. It's a very time sensitive process. And I feel like the companies that are the most responsive usually get the most out of it, because we're not waiting 2 months to file something that should be filed today. Mm-hmm. In terms of timelines too, I know you had asked me and we, you know, briefly touched on it, but for people beginning in October, we want to get the process started in May. And then for people beginning in April, we want to get the process started in November. It takes a few months, but it's not very, very timely, and it will help you plan out your year. Always forecasting is important too. So, you know, a lot of times we have companies that think they need 4 workers while they need 6, or, you know, they need 10 workers while they really need 15. So that type of forecasting is always helpful. And, you know, we want to work together. And I, you know, the other thing that I think is very important is if you see your company heading in a direction where you need H2Bs, I would start sooner rather than later. Like the first cycle is always a little bit wobbly. Like the DOL is getting accustomed to you. They're learning a little bit more about your business. They don't probably know the ins and outs of your program like they would with somebody who's applied several times, and you don't have a reserve of workers ready. So, you know, always applying a season before you actually think you absolutely need them is best practice. It won't cost you a lot, but at the same time, it will build enough stability there. So when you need them, you know, you have them.
Hmm. How can someone get a hold of you if they have questions or if they want to explore this?
So So the best way is through my website. It's muallimfirm.com, muallimfirm.com. I can also be reached at info@muallimfirm.com or via phone at 216-312-4700.
Yeah, this has been great. So I'll give you the last word. What do you want to impart? What kind of wisdom do you have to him? Nothing with the, what do you say? Something about molecular something or other. you can't go there because you'll lose us, but I'll give you the last word, Natalie.
I appreciate it. So I think, you know, my last word would be consider H2B seriously. If your company is growing, think about it as a resource. Get started early and do your best to work with somebody who knows the program very well.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for being here. This was fantastic.
I really appreciate your time and thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Snow Fighters Institute podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, become a subscriber today so you won't miss any future episodes. Don't forget, please check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.